My second point, still on the Acts of the Apostles, and I'll move off it immediately after this, is the Acts of the Apostles trustworthy as a history? Yes, Luke knew Paul, Luke wrote the Acts, but there's different things you can do when you know someone well. I could know you well and admire you greatly, and I might write a play about you. That'll be different, won't it, than if I write a history about you. The play will have, if someone reads a drama, if someone reads Shakespeare's Richard II as a history of Richard II, then they're just missing the point, aren't they? It's not a history of Richard II, it's something to do presumably with Elizabeth and the times of Shakespeare himself. But he's using the drama to say something. So there are authors, many of them, who say the Acts of the Apostles, while beautiful, engaging, interesting, revelatory, and saying wonderful things about the Spirit of Jesus and the Church, cannot be taken as an accurate, trustworthy history of Paul or of the early Church. I think they're wrong, and I want to show you now why. We'll begin with Luke's Gospel, chapter 1, the first four verses. And that's the text straight from the New Revised Standard Version. Luke opens this two-volume work. He says, "Since many have undertaken to compile a narrative of the events that have been fulfilled among us, come to their fullness and completion among us." So notice, first of all, many have undertaken. One of them is clearly Mark, undertook it. And there's other people too. We may have lost their documents, we don't know. So many have undertaken, but notice he's interested in events. "Just as they were handed on to us by those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and servants of the word." Now that's really important. Luke's gone round to the eyewitnesses, people who are actually there. What did Jesus say? What did Paul do? "I didn't meet Paul till he came to Antioch. Did you know him back in Damascus? What was he like? What was he talking about?" That's the kind of person he is. He's a theologian. We're all meant to be theologians. He's a theologian writing from religious experience. But his way of expressing theology, as I'll go on to show, is through history. Events are what interest him. So he certainly claims to be setting out to produce a history of those events. Many have done it, he says, and not only eyewitnesses, he says, he's gone to servants of the word. You can be an eyewitness and not see. Look at Jesus' life. The beloved disciple looked at Jesus and saw. What did the Pharisees see? You all know the experience, I'm sure. You can see something, and then one day you actually see it. Someone's been trying to say something to you for years, your wife or your husband or your teenage kid or your mother or father or friend, and then one day you actually hear it because your heart's ready to hear it. You've had an experience. You've read about the agony in the garden ever since you were a little kid. And then one day you have an agony in the garden and you read the text and you think, oh. Because you don't see with your eye, you don't hear with your ear. You see through your eye, yes. But if I'm not attentive and if I don't know and if I haven't got the background. So what Luke's gone is he's gone to people who not only saw, but saw. In other words, he's gone to lovers. He's gone to people who got the message and were impassionate about it, and that's what he's gone to. "I too," he says, "decided after investigating everything carefully from the very first to write in an orderly way for you, most excellent Theophilus," we'll come to him. Theophilus means lover of God, that's the name. You may have heard of Venerable Bede. He was a monk in the beginning of the 8th century in England. He wrote a commentary on the Acts of the Apostles, and he, quite beautifully at the beginning, he says, Theophilus, and he says, this means lover of God or loved by God. It can be either. There's love between you and God. And he says, if you want to read this properly, you'll have to be a lover of God and have to know that you're beloved by God. So he uses the name to invite us all to be Theophilus. So I too decided, excellent Theophilus, so that you may realize what assurance you have for the things about which you've been instructed. There's no doubt that when Luke writes his works, his aim is to reassure people that what they've heard about Jesus and what they've heard about Paul and what they've heard about Peter is really true, and to do that he's gone into terrific trouble to investigate. We're going to see he didn't get everything actually right, but he went to trouble to, and he wants to write down what the events were, so that our faith is based on events, on the real Jesus, what he really said and really did. That's his purpose. The next point, I hope I'm not being too... I told you this is going to be your hardest lecture. When we get onto the text, it'll be easier. But I do think it's important. I hope not just for me. The next important thing is, okay, let's accept that Luke knew Paul well, that his view of Paul is worth integrating into the letters. Let's assume he definitely set out to write history. We've got the proof of that, really. The third question, however, for any of you who have done any history, is very important. How was history written in the first century? That's a key question. Today we've got criteria for writing history that are very different from Thucydides or the Polybius or the various other historical writers of the Greek and Latin world. Because today most of us read, we've got filing cabinets, we've even got computers today. We don't run on our memory so much, do we? We footnote, we organise, we file, we can discover texts, we've got libraries, we've got archives. You've got to go back to when history was written, not to be read, but to be heard. Because people didn't read. Most people didn't go to school. They couldn't read. So, therefore, history, if it's going to be at all useful, has to be presented in rhetorical form. It has to use imagery and all the different clever techniques of helping people's memories, which were very good because they worked on their memories, which I don't, and therefore my memory isn't all that good. What was your name again? You know, it's because I think I can write it down somewhere and look up a list. They couldn't. So keep that in mind, that history in those days involved, you could be poetic, you could certainly be dramatic, you could bring in imagery, you could have allusions to the literature of the day, and so it's going to be a much richer but less able to be pinned down form of writing than one would expect of a modern historian. However, what I discovered, to my pleasure, was that history in the first century was not just, you couldn't do anything, it wasn't drama, it was history. And they did have criteria that they expected historians to follow, and therefore Luke would have been expected to follow them. I'll just give you two pages to show you this. Polybius is a Roman historian, writing in Greek, of course. It's died in 122 BC, and he wrote many volumes called The Histories. And he says, this is not a quote now, but he says that the best thing for a historian is to write about matters that he personally witnessed. That's obvious. But he goes on to say, since many events occur at the same time in different places, and one man cannot be in several places at one time, nor is it possible for a single person to have seen with his own very eyes every place in the world and all the peculiar features of different places, the only thing left for an historian is to inquire of as many people as possible, note this, to believe those worthy of belief, and to be an adequate critic of the reports that reach him. So since you can't be everywhere, you go to people who were there, you ask them questions intelligently, you don't just believe them, you check them, and then if the report is trustworthy and double-checked and all that, then you'll consider it right. secondhand because you didn't know it yourself. He's critical, this Polybius, of a contemporary historian called Timaeus, who, he says, he diligently pursued the reading of books, but was very remiss in his interrogation of living witnesses. Personal inquiry, says Polybius, is the most important part of history. Now, there we've got quite a big difference, I think. If any of you have anything to do with archives, and you may, if any of you ever leave behind you documents that may one day appear in an archive, and you may, you know about shredding. Difficult to avoid hearing about that. You also know that I think you'd be careful what you wrote because you wouldn't want it to be read necessarily. Or you might want it to be read, so you write it and file it. So written documents aren't always what they appear. Hard copy looks hard. It looks trustworthy, but we all know it, you can't question someone who's dead and has left a file behind in a cabinet. You can question a living person. So that's what Polybius is saying. Yeah, go to your libraries, but it's much more important to be in connection with people who are really there, and you can really check what did they see, did they hear that, are they sure that's what was said, you know, and you can question and interact with them. Last thing on Polybius, he's not impressed by those who, after spending a long time in libraries and becoming deeply learned in memoirs and records, persuade themselves that they are adequately qualified for the task of being an historian. You'll be pleased to know this is the end of this first point I'm making. Lucian of Samosata, who died in 180 AD, wrote a book, How to Write History. I'm trying to get the idea of how history was written at the time of Luke. And he says, the sole task of the historian is to tell things just as they happened. However, he goes on to say this. If someone has been brought in to give a speech, you'll see how important this is in a moment. Above all, let the language suit the person and the subject. It's then that you can exercise your rhetoric and show your eloquence. You see, by inquiry you can find out what someone did and that person gave a speech on a certain occasion. But if there are no tape recorders, if there's no hard copy of the speech, how can you find out what he actually said? It's a bit difficult, isn't it? So you can ask people what they heard, but that's what you're getting. You're getting what they heard. Different people hear different things. If you can find the author and ask him, he might remember what he said or he might get it confused. So you're in a more difficult thing. And why this is important is that 22% of the Acts of the Apostles is made up of speeches. So as a history document, you're often going to hear Paul 6 times, give long speeches. What are you getting when you do that? You must know, and I'm sure you do know, Luke is the author of those speeches that Paul has given. He has to be the author of the speech. But what I'm trying to show you here is that historians of the day expected that you didn't just make up the speech to say what you'd like him to have said. You have to do your inquiry. You can be eloquent, yes, you can make your points, and we'll find Luke giving his theology and his understanding directly, but indirectly, let's go on a bit. Thucydides, who died in 400 BC, has this to say. Historians can compose speeches, of course, but only after careful investigation and only with the aim of giving the general sense of what was actually said. If you're a dramatist, do what you like. Friends, Roman countrymen, lend me your ears. If you're a historian, you've got to actually go do your homework and as best you can find out what was said on that occasion. Polybius, whom we talked about earlier, has this to say. If writers, after indicating to us the situation, the motives, the inclinations of the people involved, report in the next place what was actually said, and then make clear to us the reasons why the speaker either succeeded or failed, we shall arrive at some true notions of the actual facts. To conclude my first point with you, I would like to reassure you, though there'd be plenty of scholars who would disagree with me, I'd be happy to argue with them, but I want you to know there is disagreement. I'm happy to advise you that as we're studying Paul, we can use the speeches of Paul in the Acts as a secondary but genuine and very helpful insight into Paul's thought. We can use the Acts of the Apostles, chronology, movements of Paul, because we need some background. If you write a letter, I think I would want to know whether you wrote it when you were 18 or 80. I think I'd want to know whether you wrote it before the Second World War or after September the 11th, do you see? Because it's a letter. I'd like to know who you were responding to when you wrote and what the situation was when you wrote it. So I'd like to know whether when Paul writes to the Corinthians, is he writing from Ephesus or Rome or Caesarea or Jerusalem? Do you get me? These are important issues because you write where you are, as you are, in response to real situation somewhere. And listening to a letter is like listening to one half of a telephone conversation. You can often get it wrong. And we haven't got the letters they wrote to him that he was replying to. So the more help we can get, tentative, sometimes very confident, the more we're likely to understand what Paul was really wanting to say with the words he was using. And I think it would be, why leave out the Acts of the Apostles when it's written by someone who really knew Paul, whom the early church saw as Paul's disciple, who travelled with Paul, who loved Paul, who listened to Paul, who could talk to Paul about what he said, and who was determined to write about events to give assurance to people that their faith is based on real facts and not on some new Eastern, in those days, mystical cult that had lovely ideas, poetic ideas, but wasn't really grounded in reality. So I will be using Acts in helping you understand Paul. And now one last thing, but a very important thing on this. History, still on Acts, but it's important. History is not just about events. Clearly, you know that. If a historian just piles up everything that happened and footnotes it all, it's not only boring, it's irrelevant, it's just too much. Cooking a meal is not about putting every ingredient possible in a cupboard. It's about bringing them together with a view to producing something edible. So writing history is about the meaning of things, the connection between things, the significance of things. And when you write history, when Luke writes history, he's looking at history at two levels, and it's quite important to see them. On the one level, and this is for us too, there's the level of cause and effect. There's a level of what people do, what they decide, what happens, what the results are, what people decide to do with it. This is all our human stuff in the tangle of our minds and in the vagaries of history. We're all half in the dark doing things and they're all having some kind of effect, and probably no one will see the effect till 50 years' time, and then they may misunderstand it. But that's what we're doing. Okay. So, but history can be looked at, must be looked at another level, and that is, what is God doing here? What is happening at a larger level of love and faith and deep meaning? Now you're into something that requires a whole lot of perception that many of us mightn't have. But if someone is as insightful as Luke and as prayerful and as inspired as Luke, and he's dealing with someone who is as insightful and inspired as Paul, you're dealing with very rich minds and very loving people whose religious experience is quite acute. and quite perceptive, obviously, and so perceptive, it's so convincing. People are convinced by their words, and they're not charlatans. So there's a lot of wonderfully deep things happening, and Luke will be looking in the Acts of the Apostles, not just for what Paul said and where he was, but what is Jesus doing here? It's about the risen Christ. It's about Jesus who said, I will be with you all days until the end of time. It's about the action of God through people. Now, God isn't running the world. We're not puppets. God loves the world, and you and I can at any moment resist. We can say no, and it won't happen. We can, as Luke himself says, like the Pharisees, we can frustrate God's will for us. We can, because of who we are. We can sin. We can stop beautiful things happening by just being hard-hearted and whatever else we can do. So God doesn't run the world like a puppeteer. God loves and inspires. Jesus showed us that God is love. God never is anything but love. But like the light coming in through the curtained windows, if we open the curtains and open the blinds, the light shines in. If we close the blinds, the room's in darkness. The sun is still shining. The light is still there. The love doesn't stop. So God doesn't stop loving me or loving you or loving Peter or loving Paul or loving the people in Jerusalem or Pilate or ever. God can't, won't, doesn't, because God is love. But love, while it's unconditionally offered, is conditionally received. And you all know you can offer love and people reject it. Love isn't automatic by any means. It's a communion that requires two free people to say yes to it. So God is saying yes all the time. And that's what Luke sees. He also sees the human tragedy and the human comedy of people saying yes to love and saying no to love. And Paul trying to inspire them to say yes, but many resisting, and the struggles of our... So there's the levels that we're watching, and we're going to watch the same levels when we're looking at Paul. These people have an insight into the spiritual dimensions of life, into the divine activity, into the Holy Spirit. And the whole New Testament is about what Jesus now, after his death, the Gospels, when he dies on the cross, how is Jesus active? And if we can find that, helped by Luke and Paul together, we'll then be open to see how God, how Jesus, how the loving God is acting in our lives.